Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading today are from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. They've all been published in October of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. We're going to begin with this article titled, "The Celebrities Are Saying the Loud Part Quietly." Democratic politics and pop culture have long been entangled, but entertainers seem a bit more sheepish about their endorsements lately. By Spencer Kornhaber. With his hat low over his eyes and the sharpness in his voice sheathed, Eminem seemed slightly less than amped to be at the Kamala Harris campaign rally last Tuesday in Michigan. In a minute and 15-second speech with nary a punchline or pun, the 52-year-old rapper saluted Detroit, voting, and freedom, and closed with all the passion of an HR professional giving a benefits update. Here to tell you much more about that, President Barack Obama. Obama took it upon himself to play the part of the showman. Summoning his goofiest dad energy, he hooted the words of Eminem's "Lose Yourself," claiming he was so nervous that he had vomit on my sweater already, Mom's spaghetti. This line shook me to my millennial core. It echoed the time at a North Carolina rally in 2008 when Obama cited Jay-Z lyrics by brushing some metaphorical dirt off his shoulder, a moment that christened an era in which Democratic politics and pop culture were brazenly intermingled. Partisanship and hipness seemed, ever so briefly, compatible. But as Eminem's anti-performance had just indicated, we are now so far from then. With veteran public idealists such as Bruce Springsteen and the West Wing cast on the trail for Harris lately, and with Donald Trump touting old allies such as Kid Rock alongside recent converts from hip-hop, it can be easy to overlook just how much celebrity culture's relationship to political culture has shifted over the past few cycles. Mainstream entertainers have, as is typical, lined up for Democrats, but they have, as is less typical, not tried to make much fuss about their participation. They seem to understand that the nature of celebrity itself has changed, and that praise from the glitzy class can be a liability. Revisit, if you dare, the 2008 Will.i.am music video, "Yes We Can," which featured a motley cast of stars: Scarlett Johansson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Herbie Hancock, speaking, singing, and piano playing along to Obama's soaring rhetoric. The video's earnestness, so cringeworthy today, gives the lie to the summer hype about Harris recapturing Obama mania. Moreover, it embraces an obsolete and always shaky cultural vision. The arts, as represented by one unified team of dreamers whom voters tend to admire rather than despise. The 2016 Hillary Clinton campaign, leaning on star-studded concerts and a sitcom cameo, learned the hard way that this vision had started to die out in the 2010s because of both technological and political shifts. Chopping the primetime viewing masses into factions, social media, and streaming platforms turned out to be resentment-making machines. It is simply annoying to be told that an actor is important and popular when you, in your own media consumption, never encounter his or her work. Trump was a perfect champion for the resulting and widespread sense of cultural dislocation. He was an entertainer, sure, but an entertainer who humiliated other entertainers on his TV show. When Hollywood began pumping out resistance-themed entertainment early in his presidency, it produced little art of lasting significance, but it did bolster Trump's claims to be aligned with the people rather than the elites. 8 years later, after the pandemic spread yet more disunity and QAnon spread conspiracy theories about what goes on inside Hollywood's private corridors, mistrust of celebrities seems to be at a high. On talk radio and TikTok, one of the hottest cultural topics of the moment is the sexual abuse accusations against Sean Diddy Combs. The stories articulated in the federal indictment and dozens of civil suits against him are chilling. Combs denies them, but the chatter they've inspired on social media tends not to be focused on sympathy for the victims. Rather, many commentators seem gleeful, with hope that the investigation into Combs will take down the many stars who attended his white parties, events that for years symbolized the height of aspirational excess in pop culture. Trump used to brag about his closeness with Combs, but that hasn't stopped him and his surrogates from continuing to tag Democrats as the party of celebrity decadence. Trump shared a fake image of Harris with the rapper. Elon Musk recently posted on X, in response to Eminem's presence at Harris's rally, "Yet another diddly party participant?" Mass antipathy towards celebrities does not mean, however, that stars don't matter anymore. Quite the opposite. This is the age of stans, a word partially coined by Eminem, which now refers to internet-enabled super-fandom. Stans are not just loyal to particular entertainers. In many cases, they're monomaniacal and tribalist, rooting against rivals just as much as they root for their faves. At the same time, the rise of influencers, a term that can refer equally to a TikTok goofball and a philosophy podcaster, is helping further break down the border between entertainment and media. An influencer's job isn't merely to amuse, it's to spread ideas and opinions. We've evolved into a polytheistic celebrity culture, worshiping countless mini-idols that command a different form of adulation in each household. The structure of this new fame ecosystem doesn't fit neatly with national politics. Authenticity, the feeling that a celebrity is showing their real self, is what attracts fans, and nothing is less authentic than being a partisan hack, especially given the disillusionment spread by the pandemic, inflation, and the war in Gaza. Celebrities who want to talk about the election are probably smart to cultivate an air of reluctance. Take, for example, Call Her Daddy's Alex Cooper, who gave a lengthy apologetic explanation to listeners before interviewing Harris on her podcast. As you know, I do not usually discuss politics or have politicians on this show, because I want Call Her Daddy to be a place where everyone feels comfortable tuning in. One of the most haunting pieces of media from this election season is The Daily Show's recent dispatch from the Gathering of the Juggalos, the music festival thrown by the face-painted rap metal group Insane Clown Posse. the fans, called Juggalos, who were interviewed, profess all sorts of liberal leanings about abortion, the economy, trans rights, but also say they're non-voters, seemingly as a matter of identity, of pride, they feel outside the system. Violet J., one of ICP's two members, told The Daily Show that he supports Harris, but really he didn't seem to care very much about the election either way. He didn't even know who Tim Walz is. Even the most plugged-in stars seem a bit detached. Chappelle Roan, the breakout singing sensation of the year, has rejected calls for her to endorse a candidate. After backlash, she clarified in a TikTok video that she would be voting for Harris, but that because of various issues, primarily America's support for Israel's war, she couldn't rightly call that vote an endorsement. In September, Taylor Swift gave Harris a much clearer boost, but her Instagram post on the matter was strikingly muted in tone, especially given Trump's efforts to troll her. She hasn't weighed in on the campaign since then. Don't bet against some crucial last-minute activism. Swift is, among many other things, a master of timing. Then there's Eminem. The rapper is a pretty prize for any political campaign. More than two decades after his first hit, he still commands a huge following among young men, a demographic that may well decide this election. The news that he's voting blue isn't much of a surprise, but he seems to be refining his methods with each election. During the 2016 campaign, he released an anti-Trump diss track. Its opening line lives on as a memeable example of how clunky protest art can be. During 2020, a campaign waged mostly online and in ads, he lent Lose Yourself, the ultimate inspirational anthem, to a Biden-Harris commercial. This time he gave that short halting speech, and it was in its way perfect for this cycle. The video is likely to pop up in the TikTok or Instagram reel feeds of fans, many of whom might find Eminem's palpable sense of burnout relatable, and his words, therefore, more credible. This past Friday brought to the campaign trail one of America's highest wattage figures, Beyoncé, who spoke at a Harris rally in Houston, along with her mother, Tina, and her Destiny's Child bandmate, Kelly Rowland. Beyoncé's potential involvement in this election has been speculated about for months. Her track, Freedom, became Harris's rallying song, and fans theorized feverishly and incorrectly that she'd perform it at the Democratic National Convention. But when Beyoncé finally joined Harris on stage on Friday, it wasn't to sing or dance. In a calmly uplifting speech, she focused on the historical nature of electing the first black female president, and she added this crucial stipulation, "I'm not here as a celebrity." And that completes the article. The author, Spencer Kornhaber, is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and the name of his article was "The Celebrities Are Saying the Loud Part Quietly." Our second article is titled, "Trump Wants You to Accept All of This as Normal." The former president is psychologically preparing Americans for an assault on the electoral system, by Anne Applebaum. In the final week of this election season, the Republican Party is running two different campaigns. One of them is an ugly and angry but conventional political enterprise. Donald Trump and other Republicans make speeches. Party operatives seek to get out the vote. Money is spent in swing states. Television and radio advertisements proliferate. The people running that campaign are focused on winning the election. Last night in New York City's Madison Square Garden, we caught a glimpse of the other campaign. This is the campaign that is psychologically preparing Americans for an assault on the electoral system. A second January 6th, if Trump doesn't win, or else an assault on the political system and the rule of law if he does. Listen carefully to the words of Tucker Carlson, the pundit fired from Fox News partly for his role in lying about the 2020 election. Warming up the crowd for Trump, he mocked the very idea that Kamala Harris could win. It's going to be pretty hard to look at us and say, you know what? Kamala Harris, she got 85 million votes because she's so impressive as the first Samoan, Malaysian, low IQ, former California prosecutor ever to be elected president. Samoan Malaysian was Carlson's way of mocking Harris's mixed race background, and low IQ is self-explanatory. But 85 million is a number of votes she could in fact win. And how, Carlson suggested, could there be such a groundswell of popular support for a person he demeaned as a mongrel and incompetent, an idiot? The answer was clear. There can't be, and if anyone says it happened, then we will contest it. All of this is part of the game. The Trump campaign's loud confidence, despite dead-even polls, its decision in the final days to take the candidate outside the swing states to New York, New Mexico, and Virginia, because we've got this in the bag, and not, say, because filling arenas in Pennsylvania is getting harder. The hyping of Republican early voter numbers, even though no evidence indicates that these are new voters, just people who are no longer being discouraged from voting early. Also, the multiple attempts across the country to remove large numbers of people from the rolls, the many claims with no justification that illegal immigrants are voting, or even, as Trump implied during the September debate, that illegal immigrants are being deliberately imported into the country in order to vote. Vance's declaration that he will accept the election results as long as only legal American citizens vote. At Madison Square Garden, Trump doubled down on that rhetoric. He repeated past claims about the invasion of immigrants, about Venezuelan gangs occupying American cities, even Times Square, and he offered an instant solution. On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history to get these criminals out. I will rescue every city and town that has been invaded and conquered, and we will put these vicious and bloodthirsty criminals in jail. But he left open the question of who exactly all these criminals might be, because he seemed to be talking about not just immigrants, but also his political opponents, the enemy within. The United States, he said, is now an occupied country, but it will soon be an occupied country no longer. November 5th, 2024, 9 days from now, will be Liberation Day in America. The insults we heard from many speakers at Madison Square Garden, including the description of Puerto Rico as garbage, or of Harris as the Antichrist, or of Hillary Clinton as a sick son of a bitch, insults that could also be heard in 1,000 podcast episodes featuring Carlson, Elon Musk, J.D. Vance, and their ilk, are part of the same effort. Trump's electorate is being primed to equate his political opposition with infection, pollution, and demonic power, and to accept violence and chaos as a legitimate, necessary response to these primal, lethal threats. As I wrote earlier this month, this kind of language, imported from the 1930s, has never before been part of mainstream American presidential politics, because no other political candidate in modern history has used an election to undermine the legal basis of the American political system. But if we are an occupied country, then Joe Biden is not the legitimately elected president of the United States. If we are an occupied country, then the American government is not a set of institutions established over centuries by Congress, but rather a sinister cobble that must be dismantled at any price. If we are an occupied country, then of course the Trump administration can break the law, commit acts of violence, or even trash the Constitution in order to, quote, liberate Americans, either after Trump has lost the election or after he has won it. This kind of language is not being used accidentally or incidentally. It is not a joke, even when used by professional comedians. These insults are central to Trump's message, which is why they are featured at a venue he reveres. They are also classic authoritarian tactics that have worked before, not only in the 1930s, but also in places such as modern Venezuela and modern Russia, countries where the public was also prepared over many years to accept lawlessness and violence from the state. The same tactics are working in the United States right now. Election workers whose job is to carry out the will of the voters are already the subject of violent threats and harassment. At least two ballot boxes have been attacked. The natural human instinct is to dismiss, ignore, or downplay these kinds of threats. But that's the point. You are meant to accept this language and behavior, to consider this kind of rhetoric baked in to any Trump campaign. You are supposed to just get used to the idea that Trump wishes he had Hitler's generals, or that he uses the Stalinist phrase, enemies of the people, to describe his opponents. Because once you think that's normal, then you'll accept the next step, even when that next step is an assault on democracy and the rule of law. That completes the article. Trump wants you to accept all of this as normal, by Atlantic staff writer Ann Applebaum. I'm going to take a brief moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic. All of them were published in October of 2024. We'll continue with this article now. A touch revolution could transform pitching. A revolution in the science of touch could unlock the mystery of feel in pitching, by Zach Schoenbrunn. Mariano Rivera was never secretive about the grip on his signature pitch. He'd show it to teammates, coaches, even reporters. He placed his index and middle fingers together along the seams. He pulled down with his middle finger upon release. The ball would whiz, arrow straight, before veering sharply a few inches from where the hitter expected it. When teaching pitchers how it should feel coming out of their hand, however, Rivera could be frustratingly vague. "Put pressure on the middle finger," he would say. "This can be a moneymaker for you. Even now, nobody can make a fastball move quite like Moe's. It is as if it dropped straight from the heavens, he wrote in his 2014 memoir. How can I explain it any other way? 11 years after Rivera's retirement, a wrist brace with claws could strip any last intimation of divinity out of pitching. A pitcher's fingers slide into its four rubber rings, attached to metal straws that are fastened by a Velcro strap around the wrist. This device, the Flex Pro Grip, measures exactly how quickly each of a pitcher's fingers exert pressure on a ball. But the point of the gadget isn't just to register finger forces. It's to transform the art of pitching into a science. One afternoon last year at a training facility called Velo U, I watched as Aiden Dolinsky, a pitcher for New York University, slipped on the Flex Pro Grip and awaited instructions from Adam Moreau, the device's co-creator. I want you to squeeze with your two fingers, the index and middle, but only at about 50% of your maximum pressure, Moreau said. Hold it there for a few seconds. Hold, hold, and then instantly, boom, ramp up to your max force. As Dolinsky squeezed, Moreau began peppering him with numbers. Get to 69, he said, glancing at the app in front of them. And then when you see that little green dot there, slam on it. Okay, hold, hold, go. The young pitcher needed a few tries before he mastered the proper sequence of acceleration. I realized I was squeezing too hard, so then I backed off too much, Dolinsky said. That's quantifying feel, Moreau cried. Imagine, he said, standing on the mound and knowing exactly how much force to put on each key finger and exactly how to peak them at the same time. What would that do to your spin? Today's professional pitchers throw harder than ever, but their art is still largely dictated by speculative notions of feel. Pitchers have forever been licking their fingers and clutching rosin bags to help with grip. These days, camera technology and data analysis have put a premium on players who can also impart enough spin to make the ball run, ride, cut, carry, sink, tunnel, and bore along a split-second flight path. It's not enough to be blessed with a golden arm. You need to have it work in conjunction with your fingers, too. Only recently, though, has anyone tried to understand exactly how those fingers work in pitching. In 2017, Glenn Fleissig, an expert in biomechanics, led a cohort of researchers looking at how elite pitchers apply finger pressure while throwing. By stuffing a regulation baseball with sensors, the researchers found that the force of the middle and index finger on the ball spiked twice, the last coming roughly 6 to 7 milliseconds before release. In essence, the instant the ball leaves the hand. The force of that final peak averaged 185 newtons, exerted through two fingers kissing the seams of a 5-ounce baseball. It's enough force to heave a bowling ball about 90 miles an hour. When I spoke with Fleissig, he recalled that the primary motivation around the study was injury prevention. Elbow tears are collectively a billion-dollar problem for Major League Baseball each year, and knowing how hard someone grips has implications about what's happening in your elbow, he said. What he found, though, also unlocking a mystery about pitching, Fleissig had previously reported that the angular velocity achievable by a pitcher's shoulder maxes out at about 90 miles an hour, but pitchers can throw faster than that. Something else had to be providing that extra oomph, the fingers. A huge thing that separates a good pitcher from a great pitcher, Fleissig said, is their ability to do that last push. Fleissig's work is emblematic of a recent and long overdue boom in touch research. We're now catching up to where we've been for decades in the auditory and visual fields, David Ginty, a neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School, told me. When Ginty started his somatosensory research lab in the mid-1990s, the field was small and quirky, dominated by a few labs producing a handful of papers a year. Today, the IEEE World Haptics Conference, the top symposium where touch researchers share their findings, is a sprawling, festival-like event, sponsored by a subsidiary of Meta. Advancements in molecular genetic techniques have enabled labs like Ginty's to see how individual nerve cells respond to certain stimuli. It's given researchers the best picture yet of the basic biology of touch, and it's jump-started investigations into new treatments for chronic pain, anemia, irritable bowel syndrome, traumatic brain injury, and even low bone density. A stream of studies in recent years has also highlighted the psychological, cognitive, and creative benefits of doing things by hand. In science, the closer anyone looks at touch, the more its influence becomes apparent. In baseball, it could revolutionize how teams look for the next Mariana Rivera with the magic feel. For Connor Lund's entire baseball career, feel was waved off as something subjective and abstract, mostly because it couldn't be measured. Eventually, Lund, a recently retired minor league pitcher, realized that people weren't even trying. We have every other metric out there, how hard you're throwing, all the spin rates, the tail axis, everything, Lund told me, but there was nothing out there on where you're gripping the ball. Learning how to throw a new pitch was like getting a prescription for eyeglasses based on what somebody else is telling you looks clear for them. In April, shortly before being signed as a free agent by the Tampa Bay Rays, Lund was co-awarded the patent on a design for a baseball wrapped in a pressure-sensitive fabric. Alex Fast, a data analyst and writer for PitchingList.com, also thought the role of pressure was being overlooked. In March 2023, he gave a talk at the MIT Sloan Analytics Conference in Boston about measuring finger pressure in baseball. Using sensors and other supplies bought from Amazon, he built a feedback device that was tiny and flexible enough to be worn underneath a piece of tape on the fingertip and that could transmit force data to a microcontroller worn inside a fanny pack on the pitcher's lower back. When I first got into analytics, I remember thinking that they've quantified everything, Fast told me. But so many people that he spoke with after the conference shared his hunch about finger force. Fast told me later that he began to think this could be pitching's next great analytical frontier. Part of what's so noticeable about the attention being paid to touch in baseball circles is its contrast with how much of us navigate the world. I can point to one tool I reliably touch in my daily life, my iPhone, with its flat, smooth surface. I tap, scroll, and occasionally pinch it. Calling it a touchscreen is an insult to the various forms of touch humans once used to manipulate pens, books, Rolodexes, keys, cash, coin, camcorders, calculators, discs, tapes, and credit cards. In households around the world, voice assistants and smart devices already respond nimbly to vocal commands to turn on lights, play songs, set temperatures, and change television channels. Hands-free fixtures fill the bathroom. Telehealth visits replace physical exams. Virtual reality has barely any use for the hands or feet. That our grip on the physical world is slipping has real consequences. A long history of medical study has connected hand strength to overall physical health and longevity, for reasons that still aren't entirely clear. Christy Isbell, a pediatric occupational therapist at East Tennessee State University, said she sees some kids as old as 4 or 5 years who have never held a pencil or a crayon. The absence of that tactile experience may change how they learn to read and write, she told me, and limit them in other ways. Healthy young adults who spend lots of time on their smartphones have weaker grips, duller fingers, and higher rates of hand and wrist injuries than their peers who use their phones less frequently. Professors at medical schools are raising alarms about the diminishing dexterity of surgical students. Pitchers are an outlier. Unlike the rest of us, they must be attuned to precisely how their fingertips interact with the world every time they take the mound. And simply paying a little more attention to that interaction appears to make a great difference, according to research by the company that manufactures the Flex Pro Grip. Pitchers who use the device have been able to increase the rate of spin on their fastball by about 4%. A higher spin rate on a fastball can produce a rising effect that makes it harder for hitters to square up. Even if the rest of us never get our finger pressure measured, the research is clear that we can benefit emotionally, cognitively, and physically by doing more with our hands, by jotting down notes, knitting, or taking a pottery class. With that effort and the help of a few committed baseball buffs, perhaps we can arrest our collective drift into a hands-free world. That's the end of the article. The author, Zach Schoenbrunn, is a senior editor at The Week magazine and the author of The Performance Cortex. He writes about science and technology in his Substack newsletter, Science of Skill. And the name of his article was A Touch Revolution Could Transform Pitching. The title of this article is The People Who Don't Read Political News. It's More Tempting Than Ever to Ignore the Election, by Olga Kazan. When Brian Jarrell, an evangelical pastor in Ligonier, Pennsylvania, came across an election-themed episode of a podcast, he'd skip right over it. He would mute the TV when political ads came on, tried to teach his social media feeds that he wasn't interested in politics, and would throw campaign mailers straight in the trash. He'd skim news headlines sometimes, but if he could tell that the story was about national politics, he'd keep scrolling. Today, exactly 1 week before the election, he will begin researching both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump and make a decision about whom to support. He's not sure where he'll land. He is conservative on some social issues, but he doesn't like Trump's character. Jarrell represents a set of Americans who, out of anxiety, exhaustion, or discouragement, are mostly tuning out campaign coverage, yet will ultimately participate in the election. they're political ostriches, who at the last minute will take their head out of the sand. For a decade now, people have started talking about news fatigue. Ken Doctor, a news industry analyst, told me, people are tired of being bombarded with the news, and then it kind of matured into news avoidance. This tendency escalated with the increasing ubiquity of both online news and Donald Trump, Doctor said. Jarrell started purposefully ignoring campaign coverage after he noticed that his parishioners would come to him in the lead-up to elections and describe genuine fear about one candidate or the other taking the White House. He decided to recommend this strategy of abstaining from the news until the final week of the race to his parishioners and to follow it himself. How much energy did America collectively spend imagining a Biden-Trump election only in July to have Biden drop out? Jarrell said to me. If you wait till the last week, there's still enough time to make an informed decision, but you haven't wasted all that emotional energy stressing about something that may not even come to pass. A sizable percentage of Americans seem to feel similarly. A 2022 Reuters Institute report found that 42% of Americans sometimes or often actively avoid the news, up from 38% in 2017. The most common reasons people gave for avoiding the news were that it focused too much on politics and COVID, that it was biased, and that it made them feel unhappy or fatigued. In April, the Pew Research Center reported that 62% of Americans were already worn out by coverage of campaigns and candidates. A May poll by NORC at the University of Chicago found that 49% of those surveyed either agreed or strongly agreed with the statement, "I'm tired of receiving and processing news about the 2024 presidential election." Not caring about politics is a hallmark of what political scientists call low-information citizens. But unlike many in the low-information camp, political ostriches do intend to vote. They just don't feel the need to follow the news in order to do so. The reason ostriches and others avoid political news is simple. It's all negative. It's divisive. I'm sick of it, the Democratic pollster Selinda Lake told me, relaying the views she hears in focus groups. In Jacksonville, Florida, 31-year-old Tanya Barker didn't watch the debates, and on social media, she scrolls past political news, skipping what she feels are inflammatory, heavily one-sided articles. She plans to vote for a third-party candidate. Neither Trump nor Harris really seem like they're actually going to do anything to help us, she told me. Barker, who in 2016 supported Bernie Sanders, seemed disappointed by the fact that Hillary Clinton was the Democratic nominee that year. Whoever's running stuff behind the scenes is just going to pick who they want to pick, and we just have to go along with it, she said. Cheryl Wilson Obermiller, a 66-year-old near Kansas City, Missouri, told me that she and her husband have swapped watching the news for taking walks or watching, say, Masterpiece Theater. She finds the news inflammatory, addictive, and occasionally insulting to people like her. She's voting for Trump. She asks herself, am I wasting time watching politics when I could be helping my neighbor? And I think that's something we all have to consider. Am I watching politics that are feeding in me an attitude that would make me look down on or dislike people? Obermiller still spends about an hour a day either reading or watching the news, down from about 4 to 6 hours several years ago. She gets the news that she does consume through Facebook groups and from Fox News's Greg Gutfeld, because I think he's funny, even though a lot of times he says things that I kind of laugh about, but but I think are kind of mean, she said. Ignoring political news has become easier in recent years. Nearly half of Americans don't subscribe to any news sources. Those seeking to dodge campaign coverage can choose to spend their time on apolitical TikToks and Instagram reels, and watch Netflix instead of CNN. For people who are not interested in politics, which is most people, it's actually easier than ever to not watch news shows, to not have the algorithm in your social media feeds give you political information, David Brockman, a political scientist at UC Berkeley, told me. Brockman found in a recent study that just 15% of Americans watch at least 8 hours of partisan TV, such as Fox or MSNBC, each month. However little you think voters care about politics, you will still always overestimate how much they care, Brockman said. This helps explain why both Trump and Harris are appearing on podcasts, such as The Joe Rogan Experience and Call Her Daddy. They're trying to get around people's I hate politics filters. If people are tuning out, it might not matter much for the election results. Most people already know whom they're going to vote for. The universe of truly undecided voters is very small, likely less than 15% of the electorate. The vast, vast, vast majority of voters settle into who they're voting for whatever reasons they are, and then that's kind of that. And there's no information that they can get that is going to bump them off. Dan Judy, a Republican pollster with North Star Opinion Research, told me, there's really a small number in most political campaigns of voters who are truly persuadable. The willfully tuned out will likely end up voting for whichever party they've always supported, but they will have suffered less agita in the process. Gerald, the pastor, feels that his approach to the news has made him more serene and has given him more time to focus on his church and family. I believe that there's a loving God in control of the universe, he said, and no matter who's in the Oval Office, God's still in heaven, and things are going to be okay. There's a hope he shares surely, with Americans of all political persuasions. That's the end of the article, The People Who Don't Read Political News, by Atlantic staff writer Olga Kazan. The last article today is from the Dear James column. My colleague repeats herself constantly, and I'm losing my mind, by James Parker. Every Tuesday, James Parker tackles a reader's existential worry. He wants to hear about what's ailing, torturing, or nagging you. Submit your lifelong or in-the-moment problems to Dear James at theatlantic.com. And here is a reader's concern. Dear James, I find myself growing irritable at one thing in my life and one thing alone. I work with an older woman who repeats herself constantly. She has the same three jokes and says them daily, and expects us all to laugh and or respond as if we hadn't heard them before. I notice my younger colleagues nodding and smiling. I am less genteel. In fact, I seethe at my desk, rolling my eyes so far back in my head, I fear they may get stuck. It creates a rage in me that is truly inexplicable. I like to think a younger me would just ignore it and laugh on cue, but current me has considered quitting this great job over not being able to handle something so insanely trivial. I'm sure you're thinking, well, if that's the worst thing in your life, you're doing okay. But I do have real things to worry about. They don't seem to affect me like this. It's just this one stupid thing. Does the irritability of minor annoyances worsen with age? I thought that with age came wisdom. One would think I would be wise enough to not let this rattle me to my core so much. I've truly considered that I might be going insane. Dear reader, oh, I feel it. The dreadful imposition of another's sensibility, the silent rancor of the oppressed, the sensation, as you listen to this poor lady and her jokes, that your time, your life, your essence is being not just wasted, but forced slowly backwards through your veins. I say, poor lady. But she's also kind of an unwitting tyrant, isn't she? A helpless autocrat in the workplace. Her attempts at humor, horribly renewed each morning, have become a reign of terror. As for age bringing wisdom, I don't know. Age brings little rashes in awkward places. Age brings the end of patience. I'm going to quote an expert in this field, myself. Patience, one discovers, is not a virtue but a quantity, like oil in the car or milk in the fridge, not limitless and oceanic, but quite finite. I ran out years ago. All I have now is stamina. I can endure. Radiant with suppressed exasperation, I can hang in there. But clearly you have hung in there too long. You have endured enough. It's time to sort this out before you scream, quit, or brain this person with a stapler. First stop, the heart, your heart, which can be reached in this case via the imagination. Make an imaginative effort with this woman. To me, she sounds lonely or stuck. What in her life and in her inner life has so drastically narrowed her awareness? How did she get stranded with this routine, with these three terrible jokes? We never know, unless we know, what other people are going through, what it costs them to just keep showing up in however reduced a form. I try to keep in mind these lines from Franz Wright. Someone in hell is sitting beside you on the train. Somebody burning unnoticed walks past in the street. Second confrontation. Nothing succeeds like direct action. I don't mean yelling or a terrible scene. I mean something like said with as much gentleness and good humor as you can muster, and you'll have to dig deep. You know what? I've heard that one, Gloria. You may be amazed at the result. Think of it as a service to you both, a double emancipation. The second question is, Dear James, I've had insomnia my whole life. Sleep and I are in an abusive relationship. I've had all the tests, EEGs tell me I have too much REM. I've done all the things, CBT1, Ambien, Benzos, Benadryl, Melatonin, in various combinations. I sometimes fall asleep well and then wake up sweating, feeling sick about dreams about babies hatching from eggs in a creek behind a retired paint factory, or pulling dozens of mummified rats out of my floorboards and getting arrested for mailing them to Donald Trump, or driving a flying school bus full of children through the Bermuda Triangle. Other times I feel like I'm almost asleep all night, but not quite. A lot of the time while I'm awake in the night, I'm having existential dread. It doesn't help that I studied existentialism and sleep disorders between undergrad and grad school. I feel like no one has told me anything new. I know all the things and I know I am doomed. Sometimes I try to imagine myself happy, like this is good for me or I'm better at this than anyone else. So ha, the joke's on you. But how long can I delude myself? Dear reader, the worst thing about insomnia for me is the sense of overexposure to my own brain. But your brain is much more interesting than mine. Look at all this imagery. I'm actually rather jealous of your visions and reveries and between states. not for you the tedious binary of being awake / being asleep. You're also a vivid writer, so I recommend plunging into the half-realm, the hypnagogia, and making it your own. Write it up. For an idea of how to proceed, read Thomas De Quincey's Confessions of an Opium Eater. De Quincey was very good on the teemingness and fathomlessness of the drifting mind. And listen to Aphex Twin, Selected Ambient Works, Volume 2, would be the place to start. Sweet dreams. And that's the end of Mr. Parker's column today, My Colleague Repeats Herself Constantly, by James Parker. And that also ends the broadcast today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you found it informative as well. I've been reading from the online edition of The Atlantic. The articles I've read were all published in October of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona on a 24/7 basis. And if you've missed a program that you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website. In the left part of the screen, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then click on the word Demand in the center of the screen. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.